Chapter 42. Tiger, Tiger. Though our excursion with Krishna had not lasted much more than a week, on our return to Bangalore we found that during our absence changes had taken place. The Ouija board, formerly so much in request, now stood idle. In fact, Rajgopal told us, he had decided to give up spiritualism altogether. After our departure, the demands of their spirit guide, Swami Vivekananda, had become so incessant and so outrageous that they threatened to disrupt the whole tenor of their existence. He himself had found it impossible to attend to his official work. His son had been unable to go to school, and his wife had had no time for her domestic duties. Swami Vivekananda wanted to take them over completely. And for this, he admitted with cheerful frankness, they were not yet ready. Sessions with the Ouija board had therefore been discontinued, and he now relied for spiritual guidance on holy men with whom he was in actual physical contact. With the Ouija board out of the way, Rajgopal's bungalow was a much quieter place, and I would not have minded passing the remainder of our time in South India under his friendly and hospitable roof. But this was not to be. Before our departure for the north, we had a second excursion to make, though one of a rather different character from the first. Having heard from Krishna a full account of our journey, Yelahanka Swami suggested that it would be a good idea for us to spend some time in the Divyagiri range of mountains, somewhere to the north of Bangalore, where many ancient sages had lived, and where some of them were reported to be still residing. No sooner was this suggestion conveyed to us than Satchapriya was impatient to be off. "We had wasted far too much time in the company of worldly people," he exclaimed, "and listened to their worldly talk long enough, and it would be good for us to get away for a few weeks." Indeed, since we ourselves had been talking far too much, he intended to observe complete silence during the whole of our stay in the sacred mountains. I could do whatever I liked. Arrangements for the journey were soon made, and a day or two later we were in a coach with Krishna and some of the other disciples, and heading north. 2 miles from the foot of the mountains, in the midst of a vast expanse of fields, stood a double row of mud houses, one of which seemed to be a shop. Here the motor road came to an end. Leaving the coach parked in the shade of a tree, we made our way in single file through the fields, Krishna leading. Within half an hour the fields had given place to trees and boulders, and we were climbing steeply. Like Arunachala, Divyagiri seemed an enormous heap of stones, the only difference being that here the stones were not grey but black. The trees, which appeared to cover the entire mountainside, were all bell trees, sacred to the god Shiva. So thickly did they grow that, even though their leaves were nearly all fallen, it was at times difficult to get more than a glimpse of the cloudless blue sky. On the ground, embedded in the fallen leaves, lay thousands upon thousands of smooth-shelled green and yellow bell fruits, some of them almost as large as coconuts. Many were so ripe that they had split open, exposing the viscous orange meat within, and their astringent medicinal odour filled the air. When we had climbed steadily for 2 or 3 hours, the trees started to thin out, the sun shone more and more hotly in our faces, the smell of the fallen bell fruits became almost overpowering, and with a gasp of relief we emerged onto a kind of rocky terrace, 2,000 feet above the plain. To our left, backing onto the mountain, was a long, irregular structure of rough stone slabs. To our right, a low parapet wall. Having rested a while, and having warned us that the mountain was full of leopards, and that we should be sure to shut ourselves in every night, Krishna and his friends started on their return back down the mountainside, and Satchapriya and I were left alone. As soon as the sound of footsteps had died away, my companion drew a deep breath. What bliss! At last we were free from the idle and impertinent chatter of worldly-minded fools. At last we could be silent. For the next 2 or 3 weeks he was going to devote himself entirely to meditation, and under no circumstances should I disturb or interrupt him by speaking. If, in my foolishness, I attempted to do so, he gave me fair warning that it would be difficult for him not to lose his temper, and anything of an untoward nature that happened as a result of this would therefore be entirely my fault. Our first few days on the sacred mountain were occupied in settling down into routine that would leave us as much time as possible for meditation. Such domestic chores as were unavoidable, even in our hermit-like state, were reduced to an absolute minimum. Once a day, usually at 10 o'clock in the morning, we silently prepared khichdi from the rice and lentils that Krishna had left with us, eating the mixture with our fingers out of the same earthenware pot in which it had been cooked. Whatever was left over we had cold at night. This, with water from a nearby rock pool to assuage our thirst, was our sole means of sustenance. Once or twice, indeed, we sampled the fallen bell fruits, but even the ripest of them was so extremely bitter that we were unable to swallow more than a few mouthfuls. Cooking and eating once out of the way, our only other employments were gathering sticks for the fire, washing our robes, and bathing. The rest of the time, we were free to meditate. By the evening of the third day, our silent routine was well established, and it seemed that we could look forward to 2 or 3 weeks of peaceful contemplation, perhaps of ever-deepening spiritual experience. Having just finished a session of meditation, we were seated, as was now our custom, cross-legged on the broad, flat slabs of the parapet wall. Satchapriya was seated at the far end, where the parapet joined an enormous boulder, on a raised stone platform rather like a throne. I was seated at a lower level. 2,000 feet below us stretched the plain, its fields forming a green, yellow, and brown patchwork in the fading light. Here and there, a black and white dot moved imperceptibly in the direction of the pall of thin blue wood smoke that betokened the village. Everything seemed peaceful and serene. Sitting there on the parapet, one might well have written an Indian version of the opening stanzas of Gray's Elegy. Suddenly there was an abrupt movement above my head, and I heard Satchapriya exclaimed, "I can't stand it any longer. I'll go mad if I don't speak." Looking up, I saw my friend gazing down at me with a comical expression of distress, his mouth still half open. "Come on," he said with an embarrassed laugh. "You must speak too." Despite his appeal, however, I did not feel like breaking my silence. The spell of the evening was still on me, and I would gladly have adhered to our original compact. Moreover, after the way in which Satchapriya had warned me against disturbing or interrupting him, I could not resist the temptation of teaching him a small lesson. But I soon realized it would be not wise to continue the lesson for too long. On my failure to respond instantly to his appeal, Satchapriya's brows had contracted dangerously, and seeing that he was about to lose his temper, I broke my silence and asked him what had happened. From the time that he had started observing silence, he said, he had not had a minute's peace. His mind had been an absolute whirlpool of thoughts. At first he had done his best to stem the flood, but this had proved quite impossible, and in the end he had been completely overwhelmed. So great had been the tension that he had thought he would either explode or go mad. Now that we had been talking for a few minutes, the flow of thoughts was subsiding, the pressure diminishing, and he already felt much better. For the remainder of the week, meditation was therefore combined with discussion. Occasionally, still restless, Satchapriya explored the mountainside. From one of these expeditions, in the course of which he penetrated almost to the top, he returned pale and shaken. He had seen a hyena emerging from its lair beneath a rock, he told me. Luckily, the beast had not seen him, and the wind not being in the right direction, it had not smelt him either. But in future we would have to be more careful than ever at night. While we had little to fear from the leopards we heard snuffling at our door after dark, or snarling on the flat stone roof, a hyena was a very different matter. Unless they were cornered, leopards rarely attacked human beings, but the hyena, a killer born, had no such inhibitions. Though our breach of silence brought relief to Satchapriya, for me the change was not without its disadvantages. Discussion might give rise to a difference of opinion, and a difference of opinion, I well knew, was something Satchapriya was quite unable to tolerate, or even to understand. If you disagreed with him, you were his enemy. You were trying to humiliate him, to destroy him, and his wrath and fury knew no bounds. Well, as I understood this, and keenly as I realized the unwisdom of provoking my irascible friend, I did not always find it possible to soften an honest difference of opinion to the point of acceptability. Indeed, Satchapriya was so morbidly sensitive and so quick to take offence that he seemed to imagine differences when none existed. It was as though he had to create a difference in order to give himself an excuse for losing his temper. Something of this sort happened 2 or 3 days after we had stopped observing silence. We were bathing in the icy waters of the pool, 8 or 10 feet across and very deep, that lay beneath an overhanging fragment of rock a few yards along the cliff face from the temple. Something I said, which he interpreted as expressing a difference of opinion, upset him, and despite all my efforts to calm him down, he succeeded in gradually working himself up to a pitch of murderous fury, such as I had never before witnessed, even in Muvattiputta. He had had enough of me, he hissed, his eyes bloodshot with rage. He had allowed me to torment him with my unreasonable behaviour too long already. Now he was going to kill me. He would drown me in the pool. No one would ever know. He would tell them that I had died accidentally. Looking at him, I knew that he meant it. For the first time in my life, I was actually face to face with death. Strange to say, though I was frightened, I had no intention whatever of withdrawing the offending remark. On the contrary, I became aware of the existence within me of a rock bottom of obstinacy that made it utterly impossible for me to retract or disown any opinion which I genuinely believed to be true, even to save my life. How the episode ended I no longer recollect. At one stage Satchapriya was clutching me by the arm and preparing to hold me down under the dark water until I drowned. With my companion liable to what seemed like fits of homicidal mania, I was glad when, a day or two later, we were visited by Krishna and some of his fellow disciples. At first, however, their presence threatened to make the situation worse instead of better. Yelahanka Swami sent his greetings, they told us. In fact, he had charged them to convey them to us in a highly peculiar manner they did not profess to understand, and of which they were only the faithful transmitters. They begged us not to take offence. To the English saint, the Swami had said, you are to convey from me 2,673 prostrations. As for that Bengali fellow who is with him, you can give him 2 or 3 prostrations too, if you like. When we had recovered from the initial shock of this extraordinary message, the meaning of which we understood only too well, Satchapriya and I took counsel with Krishna and arranged for him to come again the following weekend and take us back to Bangalore. 3 days afterwards, therefore, having spent less than 2 weeks at Divyagiri, we found ourselves picking our way through the bell trees down to the plain. A few hundred yards from the foot of the mountain, the two coolies Krishna had engaged to carry what was left of the rice and lentils suddenly halted. Running beside the path, clearly visible in the loose, sandy soil, were the impressions of two enormous pairs of paws. "A leopard?" we inquired. "No," said the coolies in scared tones, "a tiger. He had passed that way only a few hours earlier. We had better hurry."